Another Sunday afternoon, another wordplay, your program by and about poets and creative writers, their craft and ideas. I'm Jeff Davis, your host today. A couple weeks ago, I traveled to Charlottesville, Virginia, and had the pleasure of meeting the extraordinary young poet Jessica Smith. She was gracious enough to make time for an interview, and we'll listen to much of that interview today. Jessica's work has not only a temporal dimension, but also exists spatially on the page, as a graphic construct. Obviously, there's no way to share the visual dimension of the work on radio, so part of its complex impact, as encountered on the page, is lost. One chapbook she mentions in the interview is also available on the web as a downloadable PDF file, and I urge anyone whose ears get caught by what they hear today to track that book down. And one use to which she puts the spatiality of her poems is to deconstruct the syntax of language. There literally are multiple ways to read her poems. It's a strategy of composition by field, if you will, that goes beyond the work of Olson, Duncan, Jonathan Williams, Robin Blazer, and others who transformed American poetry. She's not yet 30, but her work is already arresting, provocative, and clearly, notwithstanding its abstraction, deeply felt. It's always hard to assess what impact a young poet's work might have over time, but clearly Jessica Smith is off to an extraordinarily adventurous start. Let's listen now to Jessica Smith.
How did you come to be a poet? When did you start writing?
I started writing when I was like 3.
Like 3?
Yeah.
That's really early. I mean, we all start writing sort of at 3, or, you know,
well, I think
drawing.
I think I came to write and to draw at the same time,
uh-huh.
Which maybe explains something.
Uh-huh.
But I always wanted to label everything in my drawings. I didn't want to leave it up to my parents to guess what I was drawing.
Uh-huh.
Like, oh, what a nice elephant. It's not right. An elephant, it's a car. So I wanted to label everything, so I invented like a system of abbreviations, and sometimes they reappear in my poems, actually, mm-hmm. now, the ones that I remember, which are not very many.
Uh-huh.
But so I invented a series of abbreviations to label my scratchings when I was like 3.
Uh-huh.
But then when I was in first grade, I wrote a poem about a leprechaun, and I thought, like, this is the best thing ever, writing poems about leprechauns. I'm going to be a writer. But at the same time, I was 7, so I also wanted to be a paleontologist and a scientist, and I wanted to study volcanoes, and I wanted to be a teacher, so it wasn't like I wanted to be a writer. And until I was in high school, I knew that being a writer was a very bad profession to choose, that only silly people became writers, people who didn't want to make any money or ever be read. So
desire for oblivion.
So I knew that until I was like 17.
And then you forgot it.
Yeah.
Oh, you were growing up in Alabama, of course. This is in Birmingham, I guess.
Yeah.
Which was a friendly environment for writing, or
actually, it was. It was a very supportive community when I was growing up there.
Yeah,
they had a lot of readings and contests and magazines for children,
uh-huh.
and it helped me develop as a writer because they were always encouraging you to write what you knew.
Uh-huh.
And so I wrote what I knew at the age of 13 and 14,
right.
which actually ended up creating pretty tight poems, I think.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I still think they're pretty good poems.
Uh-huh.
They're definitely written by a 14-year-old, but for a 14-year-old, they're
pretty good.
Yeah. Because they don't aspire to be anything more than a poem written by a 14-year-old.
Right.
So, but the community was really supportive, and I won a lot of awards. And
great.
It was really nice.
You had early acclaim.
But I mean, for poems that, unlike the poems I write now, so more conventional.
Uh-huh. Sure, right. Poems of a 14-year-old.
Yeah.
Well, why don't you show us where you are now, or at least read for us where you are now. Let's read something from Organic Furniture Seller.
Okay.
Whatever you think will work.
Well, actually, I'll read a poem that is about my childhood.
Okay.
That's right.
Good.
All right.
Good. Yeah.
This one's called Brookwood Forest, and it's on page 60.
For those of you reading along at home.
Well, yes.
Okay.
Well, my poetry is very visual, so I like for people to have the book in
sure.
front of them.
Right. It is very visual.
Just to see that the path that I choose through the poem is not the only path, mm-hmm. and that any reader can take the poem from any direction that they choose.
Uh-huh.
So this is only one reading of the poem. There are many other possibilities.
Okay.
Okay.
So let's hear yours.
Brookwood Forest. Ivy, Ida, Edie, Krista, map, blue, green, white, ravines, Jared, Jeffrey, Tyler, headline, when her brown eyes turned blue, baby star was born. Colin, Cleo, Yvette, Emily, Katie, Abigail Adams, red cloth covered vines, oh my eye, fascinated by different prisms, biography, Galileo's daughter, I fascinated by different prisms. Emily, Laura, Beth, Chamberlain, Drew, Austin, Josh, Skip. Round buildings, mom, genie, an empty house, ball in the gutter, grape, Kool-Aid, and ice cube trays. Past lives. A picture of children studying in Indiana, histories that contain me. Oh, the loss, Amy, Sarah, the Adirondacks, a ring of fire. The library's relief map with the mountaintops pushed in like little volcanoes. Marshall, Cali, do not, Terabithia, the round, assembly, holiday, contain me. My memory, a ring of fire.
Yeah, I can see how other paths could be chosen. It's like Parataxis carried to another power.
Yeah.
Interesting. So I believe your description of what you're doing is plastic poetry.
Right.
Tell us what plastic poetry means for you.
There's a very long introduction at the beginning of my book about plastic poetry.
Right.
But,
For our listeners at home, it's on pages.
Yeah. It's you can't miss it. It's
right.
long. Okay.
And it's at the beginning of the book.
And it's at the beginning of the book.
Yeah.
But basically, my theory is that you move through the page similarly, or in a way similar to the way that you move through any architectural space or any built space. The poem is a made thing just like any piece of architecture. And like a piece of architecture, a poem is made so that you move through it, so that your eyes move through it, so that you mentally move through it in a certain way.
So it's experienced both spatially and temporally.
Yes,
uh-huh.
Exactly. So if you imagine moving through a warehouse, that's pretty simple. That's maybe similar to moving through the road signs that you read when you're driving. It happens very quickly. You don't even think about it. The space is made for you to move through it very freely. If you compare that to experimental architecture, where you are made to move through a space in some more constrained way.
You mean by walls or?
Yeah, imagine like an Escher painting.
Mm-hmm.
That the architecture in Escher paintings is wild.
Right.
So some poetry is like that, in that it makes your mind and your eyes work much differently than you would in any normal house.
Mm-hmm.
So with my poetry, I want to make you experience space and time differently than you would in a normal house.
Mm-hmm. Or poem.
Yes. If poetry is architecture, then a normal poem. Yes. Uh-huh.
Okay. Well, let's hear another one.
All right. This one is called Niagara Falls Revisited, and it's dated the 12th of April, 2003. Six American falls have changed. It arise, falling by now sweet, and your falling rise I've sweet through dessert cakes, the four dessert cakes of ice, through dessert cakes of ice view anniversary, the sun 12, no roses in bloom, only crocuses emerging, repetition, the same people, the same places, the different kisses, first kiss, second kiss, re-love, seven rainbows, the mist, 3.
Neat.
They work better when you read them silently to yourself, because you can sort of see, where you can only hear one thing at a time, mm-hmm. you can sort of see multiple things at a time, or see things out of your peripheral vision. And so your composite image of what the poem is trying to say is different than if you hear it in a string of words.
You're listening to Wordplay on WPVM 103.5 on your FM dial. And we've just heard a little bit of Suzanne Tinn's Silver Lake from her CD Mystic Journey. Now back to our interview with Jessica Smith. What relationship do you feel between what you're doing and, say, the poetry of erasure as, say, Ron Johnson practices it?
Well, I really like Ron Johnson, and a couple of similar poets, like, really liked what Joan Retallick did in After Images. But in general, there's not that much of a connection between my poetry and...
There's no source text, for one thing.
Generally, I'm working from the same tools that poets have been working with forever. Mm-hmm. That is memory and homage, shall we say, mm-hmm. that my poems are conglomerates of fragments of memory and fragments of things remembered. Mm-hmm. That is to say, source text that are not necessarily remembered correctly and
right.
that are not quoted uh-huh. and that are not manipulated in the same way that they are with an erasure text. There are a couple of poems in this book in which I've used an erasure technique, but I've used my own source text, and I would compare the erasure technique here more to Jay Millar's Mycological Studies than to Ronald Johnson's work.
Okay.
Because Jay also creates his own source material, and the remaining text is typographically altered.
Font-wise,
yeah.
Layout-wise,
exactly.
Et cetera. Uh-huh. Okay.
So it's erasure, but it's not of the grand subgenre uh-huh. of erasure.
Right. You're not taking Paradise Lost and
right.
yeah. creating.
Although it's interesting because it does look like erasure. My poetry is sort of spatially configured so it looks like it's been erased.
Right, right.
But what it's been erased from, rather than a source text, is memory. So the stuff that remains on the page is sort of the top layer of sedimentation of what my memory has recalled about a certain event. So it's erasure in the sense that you can't see all of the levels of memory that might be present. You only see the most immediate features.
Yeah. Yeah. How does a poem happen for you? How do you go about writing a poem?
Well, initially I have an idea of a shape.
A shape, okay.
And they're not shape poems like calligraphic poems. So there's not a shape of a cigarette or a mm-hmm. shape of a column. Uh-huh. But rather I have a sense of space that needs to be filled.
Uh-huh.
And
like a field or
yeah.
Yeah. Or a canvas or a
yeah, more like a field.
More like a field. Okay.
We'll go with the Olson.
Okay.
Okay. And then I have a memory and I want to convey the parts of that memory that rise immediately to the surface of my mind without conveying a narrative. Because for me, when I remember things, I don't remember them in a clear narrative. I remember bits and pieces. Mm-hmm. So I want to try to capture that fragmentation of memory in my own, in my poems,
uh-huh.
According to whatever shape it is that I've imagined.
Hmm.
So they sort of come together organically, like the shape produces a memory or the memory produces a shape.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just fill in the words where they go. And I often want to fragment the words, and sometimes the fragmentation of the words comes first. Like I'll think, you know, arise is two words. It's A and rise,
mm-hmm.
obviously.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll think, okay, what does that mean? Arise, I'll rise. How, what does that evoke for me? And how could I put it on the page so that it evokes something for someone else,
mm-hmm.
so that it allows the reader to enter the fragment and space of my memory for
mm-hmm.
a moment.
Mm-hmm. For a moment, yeah. So it's like a transcription of memory as it occurs.
Yeah.
Yeah. Huh.
And trying to recreate that,
mm-hmm.
trying to create a space where the reader has to go through the same mnemonic motions
uh-huh.
to get to the same composite
uh-huh. the same processes
idea.
Of connection
right.
Or,
yeah, right
yeah yeah interesting fascinating stuff read us another one
all right
yeah these are all by the way from Organic Furniture Seller which was published in 2004 and probably available still at your bookstores or through SPD
spdbooks.com
all right
okay so this one is called Passage. And it's from a short series that was published initially in Canada in a magazine called Dandelion. But the series is about Buffalo, which is where I went to school.
Mm-hmm.
So
both as an undergraduate and as for your MA.
Yes.
Is that correct? Yes. Good old Buffalo.
Yes. We are alumni here.
Indeed.
Okay. Still helms with irreconcilable distances, that click-click of 108 degrees in the shade. Raspberry fingers, road-cut sunsets, lucidity, translucidity of memory. First everything, lucidity, the first everything, the whole city littered with inanimate whiteness. Durchscheinende, dandelions, dead white bulbs like cotton bowls, like bold relief, they crop up, never the same. Distances, sadly, never, never distances, sadly, the same. Inanimate whiteness, unreclaimed. White flowers, they crop up. Expanses, white over everything as if it fell from the sky. Covered with the inescapable, like sugar, like cotton, like snow, like dandelions. The undulating complex of insensitive whiteness, 830. Time, seven, space. Rhizomatic network of memory. Whiteness covering cultures and shoulders, nothing cuts through, remain outside. Well, this poem is actually less about Buffalo and more about the culture shift of moving from Birmingham to Buffalo.
You were 17?
Yeah, 18. Yeah, and the distance between the color white, what that meant in both places.
Mm-hmm.
In Buffalo, the whiteness that covers everything is generally snow.
Indeed.
where in Birmingham, white has a number of connotations that are always problematic and have nothing to do with snow.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. I'll read another poem.
Yeah, do.
Okay. This one is called February, and it absolutely happens in Buffalo. Oh, actually, I'll read January first.
Okay.
January. Those old leaves, petrified in the season, trapped beneath the glassy surface, leaves the fragile things intact. The trees with their brown leaves hanging like monarchs. The melted snow freezes into raptured beneath our feet, not crunching leaves, but the silence of a part. Solid ice, our shoes skate on the sidewalk, walking by your side. Your hand squeezes mine so hard I can feel it through the excess fabric. The blues, the winter sky, I am so much a part. The frozen lake, your winter coat, my darling, those eyes. So this is February.
Okay.
One night, as I sat writing poems about blue, you came. As I sat writing poems about blue butterflies, you came. We walked through the snow, winter turning spring, the wayward rain and the honest snow coat, the trees in an icy shellac. They looked dipped in plastic. They sounded like the rumbling of bakelite in a jewelry box. I could not love you less, you buffalo in winter. It offers only a rawness. Their beauty reminded you of me. I could not love you less, your rosy cheeks, salt-stained. I see my heart in your eyes, the way you look at me with pure affection, loveliness. I know, miss me, you.
Lovely, lovely work. You don't like it?
Thank you. Well,
what does it conjure up for you?
I do like it because I remember how I felt when I wrote it. Mm-hmm. But between then and now, this book was written from 2002 to 2004. And as I've told you, I've had a lot of trouble writing since I published the book.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's some sort of postpartum
depression.
Yeah. Because I got it the last time I wrote a book, a much shorter chapbook, mm-hmm. but also conceived as a body, the way that chapbooks and books are sometimes.
Right, right.
And that chapbook is called Bird Book, and you can read it for free online. But for about a year after that, I didn't write anything. Mm-hmm. So
where would our listeners find that online?
You can just search for Bird Book, but it's at a magazine called Detumescence.
Mm-hmm. Detumescence.com. Mm-hmm. All right.
It shouldn't be difficult to find there.
Search on Bird Book and
Bird Book and Jessica Smith.
Right. Should take you there.
It's pretty good.
Is it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm very proud of the work that I did there, but...
Were you still in school at Buffalo when you did that?
We used to have these competitions, my friends and I, when I was living in Buffalo, or rather deadlines.
Mm-hmm.
And this is when I still obeyed deadlines. and so... One of us would set a deadline for everyone, and then we would all produce a chapbook by that time.
Oh, yeah.
And it ended up producing a lot of work. Uh-huh. And because I was working in a group of very fine young poets, it produced pretty good work.
Uh-huh.
So I think one of the things that's making me not write now is that I don't have such a close-knit community of poets anymore.
Right. No one to set deadlines. No one whom you love and respect setting deadlines.
No one with whom I'm in competition.
Uh-huh.
I mean, there was also definitely, for me at least, a feeling of like, well, my chapbook is going to be the best by this deadline. And I think we all felt that way because mine wasn't the best. So.
Who were some of the other people?
The other people were Matt Chambers, Chris Fritton, and Rick Royer. Mm-hmm. And they're still writing, and Good. You can still find their stuff.
Good.
Yeah.
Who were some of your teachers at Buffalo?
Well, predominantly I worked with Charles Bernstein. Uh-huh. But I also took courses with Myung-Mi Kim, Susan Howe, and Robert Creeley.
Uh-huh. Creeley was still there then.
Yeah, Creeley taught his last course the first year that I was in school there.
Oh, yeah.
Luckily.
So you took
But we also had a sort of email correspondence. But Charles was really my main, mm-hmm. my main man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
His work is interesting too, of course.
Yeah, he's a remarkable teacher.
Is he?
He knows everything. Uh-huh. You can ask him. Well, he was a remarkable teacher for me when I was an undergraduate because I had a very curious mind, and whenever I had a question about something, he would know what book to direct me.
Yeah.
And he's also been very encouraging about my specific way of writing since I started writing this way, which was it was like 1998. Hmm. So, yeah. But he blurbed my book, and he's always been extremely supportive, and he's just a great person.
Uh-huh. Good. I don't know him, but
you should.
I've heard good
you
things
should
about
meet him.
Him.
He's awesome. Yeah.
Cool. Well, let's hear another poem.
Oh, okay. I'll stop gushing over Charles for a moment.
It's okay.
It's just so important as a young poet to have a mentor.
Oh, it is. Or it helps a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And to have someone who believes in you.
Right.
Because what you're doing is so potentially so destructive.
Mm-hmm. High risk.
Yeah. And to have someone who recognizes what you're doing and actually thinks that it might have some value is extremely important. Mm-hmm. So, great. This one is called Queen Street, Drottninggatan. And it's one of the poems in the book that's split in the middle. And with the split, what I'm trying to attain is that there are two memories that vacillate back and forth for me. And in this case, I'm writing about walking down Queen Street in Toronto and then walking down Queen Street in Stockholm. Hmm. And so I've juxtaposed these two memories so that they can act together. Hanging show window glass spring show afternoon glamour shoes of gestures, sparkles, receipt, many pairs of eyes, city noise and pedestrians, glances of desire, cup, dress, looking, dancing, the choreographed crowd, cover, covet, street, a straight, ballroom. The man with coffee raises his cup up, opens his mouth, arch, to early morning, moving, architecture awakening, doors and windows. The woman with the broom sweeps, arcs, stretch of sidewalk. Sun lights the time, overhead, hinge trajectories.
Neat. Well, Jessica, thanks very much for
Thank
sitting
you.
Down today.
It's been fun.
It has been fun.